This is Writer's Voice, compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. Today, we talk with poet and novelist Honoré Fanon-Jeffers about her new book, Misbehaving at the Crossroads, Essays and Writings. Later, we air a sneak preview of our upcoming interview later in September with environmental justice champion Catherine Coleman Flowers about her new memoir, Holy Ground, on activism, environmental justice, and finding hope. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Today we're honored to have with us acclaimed poet and novelist Honoré Fanon-Jeffers. We last spoke with her about her debut novel, The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois. Today, she's here to tell us about her powerful nonfiction debut, Misbehaving at the Crossroads. It's a matrilineal memoir that spans back to the 1830s, interwoven with social history, political commentary, and poetry, as Jeffers explores themes of patriarchy, black womanhood, and the complex legacies of her own family. Misbehaving at the Crossroads explores the lives of black women in Jeffers' genealogy, using census records and oral histories. With them, she brings her foremother's stories vividly to life. But beyond memoir, Jeffers incorporates sharp social history and political commentary, touching on topics like Thomas Jefferson's abuse of his slave, Sally Hemings, the January 6 insurrection, and the election of President Obama. Jeffers also recounts darker memories, including her father's abuse and the struggles of the women in his family, his wife and daughters, to come into their own in spite of his tyrannical behavior. Jeffers' exploration of patriarchy, from her own father to the nation's founding fathers, reveals how deeply it infects the lives of women across generations. The book examines the challenges that black women in particular face in navigating social expectations of femininity while simultaneously combating oppression. Ultimately, Honoré Fanon-Jeffers shows how acknowledging difficult historical realities can be both a source of pain and a path to transcendence. Honoré Fanon-Jeffers, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
I so love this book, Misbehaving at the Crossroads, and I'm going to ask you to read something from it in a minute. But first, I'd like to ask you about the title. Tell us what it means. What are the crossroads? What is misbehaving?
I chose the crossroads as a metaphor for several things. The first is the crossroads represents an African-American and African cultures, a place where trouble meets possibility or hope. There's also, it's a place that has a sort of supernatural significance in West Africa. The crossroads is a place where people can meet deities in across the water in North America. We're probably most familiar with Robert Johnson saying he met the devil at the crossroads. In terms of my life, it is where trouble meets possibility. It's my own crossroads. And the last significance is it references intersectionality, where race crosses gender. I'm a Black woman, and I'm not just Black. And I'm not just a woman. I'm always both. That's always what I carry with me when I go out into the world.
And I'm going to come back to that in a minute. But first, I'd like to ask you to read a part of the essay, Altar Call. I think it would be good to orient us to the book.
This is what you need to know about me. I am my mother's child, though for years I pretended otherwise. Like Mama, I am a storyteller. I can paint a journey until you surrender and curl in the palm of my hand. I can bend a rhythm and make it holler. Sure enough, I'll whisper a word into submission. What else you should know is that my entire maternal line is from Eatonton, Georgia, a place of red dirt, slavery, Jim Crow, and indigenous echoes. When summers arrived, my mother would drive my sisters and me south from Durham, North Carolina. In Eatonton, I would walk the cramped street of my grandma's neighborhood, what used to be Concord Avenue. Men and boys would say I was pretty and fine. And I, a teenager who'd spent years in the Black bourgeoisie, a place where darker skin and fleshy arms and big thighs were viewed as crimes, would slow my walk in the heat. I courted that adoration. I'd had so little beauty in my life, so I drank every sweetness. I let it paint my tongue.
It's so beautiful. And you come from a long line of poets.
Yes. It's interesting. The last time I was here, you picked up on a lot. So my father, Lance Jeffers, was a well-known Black Arts Movement poet. But what I've never spoken about is that his grandfather, George Flippin, who's the first Black football player at the University of Nebraska, and he was also a medical doctor, he was a poet. He wrote poetry. I found that out only maybe about a decade ago. And he named his only son, my father's uncle, Robert Browning Flippin. So, yes, I do come from a line of, I guess, formal poets. And then I would say my mother, the way that she used language. Last week, I was in an event and I said, you know, her language perches on my tongue. Mama had a way of saying things that was so beautiful. And her siblings were the same. And her mother was the same. And her father was the same. And so they were really repositories of African-American oral tradition. But they made up things just on the fly as well.
So I want to go back, Honoré Fanon Jeffers, to what you were saying about intersectionality. First, orient us for a moment to that term and who created it. But then tell us about it in the context of Toni Morrison's Rememory. Because I think in this book, in Misbehaving at the Crossroads, I felt there was a deep connection between these two terms, intersectionality and rememory.
Well, I'm so glad you asked me to explain intersectionality and its origins, because in this era of people being online and things very rapidly moving, very few people, they use the term intersectionality. And many times people appropriate the term intersectionality, but it was coined by the great legal scholar Kimberly Williams Crenshaw to indicate Black and woman. Because what was happening was that you would have all of these sort of issues that would pop up. And people would refer to them, and they still do, which is very, it's more than annoying, it's distressing, that they will use woman as a universal term, but really who gets to be up front are white women. And so BIPOC women, Black, Indigenous, you know, women of color, they're sort of ignored. And we have very specific issues. If I may, just a little reference. For example, and I wish I had, because this is just on the fly that I'm referencing this, but there was a young woman, God bless her, in Georgia. and she became injured and then was pronounced brain dead. But because she was 10 weeks pregnant, they denied the family's wishes and kept her alive so that they could incubate her fetus. People kept mentioning, oh, this happened on The Handmaid's Tale. That bothers me because Handmaid's Tale is fiction. Black women's reproductive agency was stolen going all the way to when we were forced to cross the water. Black women were bred against their will. And when I mean bred, I mean they were forced to have intimate relations many times with Black men they didn't choose. And of course, a white man intimately assaulted them. Their children many times were sold away from them. And then later on, many Black women were sterilized against their will, including Fannie Lou Hamer. I reference her later in the book, not that issue, but Fannie Lou Hamer. So these are the issues that have specifically impacted Black women, as well as women of color. I would say mostly Indigenous women share a connection with a lot of the issues, intersectionality. In terms of rememory, gosh, what a beautiful linking that you, this is why I love to talk to you. Rememory, as coined by the great Toni Morrison, refers to cultural knowledge that is passed down, that is not always acknowledged as knowledge. For example, there is this desire to always see pieces of paper, you know, to always see the documentation. I have been guilty of that myself. If it's not written down, how can we know? Okay. But the issue is that knowledge isn't always recorded on paper. And so what happens is in African American communities, we transfer knowledge through, I don't want to say informal, because again, that privileges Western ways, but alternate ways. Let's say that, such as dreams, such as visions, such as folklore, such as storytelling on the porch. And so for me, one of the things that I've increasingly become devoted to is Toni Morrison's notion of rememory, because I come from a line of dreaming women. I come from a line of root workers and visioning women. And that's something that I've only really acknowledged very recently since Love Songs came out in 2021, because I was in academia. I've just recently retired. And when you're in academia, these sort of things are dismissed. Those sort of ways of knowing, those gestures are not viewed as scholarly. However, what helped me greatly was that at University of Oklahoma, there was a large Indigenous population. There's a large Indigenous population in Oklahoma. And then there were Indigenous scholars at University of Oklahoma. And they respected these alternate ways of knowing. People who had gone to Yale, people who had gone to Harvard, who had, you know, PhDs. And so that really helped me to acknowledge rememory as a valid way of receiving knowledge and passing knowledge on.
So I'm going to ask you to define root workers. What does that mean in the context of this book?
Root working is really folk medicine, you know, alternate medicines, but then there are ways that alternate medicine can be connected with things like dreaming. Things like, I think of what I would call my flesh song. There are times where my spirit of discernment will leap into me and I'll feel a feeling in my flesh and I'll know this is the right way to go or this is the wrong way to go. That's what root working is.
So going back to rememory, I was really struck by your piece on Thomas Jefferson, because I think that that was just such a masterful piece of rememory. It really changed the way I thought about Jefferson, because while I've had two images of Thomas Jefferson, on the one hand, the founding father, and on the other, of course, I've known he was a slave master, but the one that's been dominant in my mind has always been the former. You know, that he wrote that all men are created equal and he believed in the rightness of revolutions. So I've seen him as an exemplar of the best of American ideals. And then you make the very clear and obvious case that he was a pedophile and a rapist. So tell us about that and what your process was with that. Did you always feel that way about him? Or when you started working on this essay, how did you go below the layers of the official story to unpack this story?
One of the things that I, and perhaps it's because I've gotten older, that I have truly begun to focus on in my work is that human nature can hold so many realities in the same container. Thomas Jefferson undoubtedly was a genius. And what he gave to us in the Declaration of Independence is truly valuable. You know, you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. But I do think, and I've seen this, you know, and that's probably what came to bear as I was writing this piece. My own family, there are people who were abusive, there are people who were cruel, but they still gave gifts to folks. And that always confused me. You know, it always confused me that my father, who abused me intimately, abused my sisters intimately, was sometimes physically abusive to my mother, was verbally abusive and emotionally abusive to us all, cheated on my mother with, you know, and sometimes I just wonder how he found the time for all that he did. But I loved him. I still love him. And he gave me many great intellectual gifts, as well as a lineage that I can reach back to. So when I began thinking about Thomas Jefferson was when Annette Gordon Reed wrote her first book. It was in the 90s, Thomas Jefferson, An American Controversy, I believe. Thomas Jefferson, Sally Hemings, An American Controversy. But she wrote her first book, and she basically set out forensic evidence, even before the DNA test came back, that this man had been the father of all of Sally Hemings' children. She had a timeline. When he was gone, no pregnancies. When he came back to Monticello, within no more than 10 months, Sally Hemings had a baby, okay? So then the DNA test came back and it proved that he had fathered at least one of her children. But we pretty much know all of his children, you know. And then things started coming out at Monticello that there had been a room that had been closed off that showed that there was like this passageway from his room. And then movies started being made. And there were always these beautiful, light-skinned, nubile young women. And I was like, well, I remember when I was 14 years old and I didn't look nothing like that. And also, when I, you know, sometimes stuff will just pop in my head, Francesca, and I will just start looking stuff up. So I was like, well, I wonder what the average age of menarche was. And then I was like, 15, 16. So then you start thinking flat chest, you know, you start thinking about what the body looked like. Then when I was doing even more research for the age of Phyllis, I started looking at the age of consent. And that is when things were really started turning creepy. That in Delaware, the age of consent was 6 or 7, something like that. And then in Georgia, the age of consent was 10. I actually had a second or third cousin who had been intimately assaulted, and they forced her to marry her abuser. And so she married when she was 10 years old, and she had a baby when she was 10 years old. So I started thinking about this, and I said, what is this about? Why do they keep calling Sally Hemings a young woman? And not only Sally Hemings, but other young little girls. What I would look at as a little girl, a 12-year-old, a 13-year-old. Then they use the term concubine. They use the term mistress. And what I realized is, undoubtedly, so I begin to understand that because the majority of scholars of Thomas Jefferson were white men, they are going to frame this language so that she, and also that they had a relationship when legally she could not say no. And then you get these people saying, well, why would she want to? I mean, she got, and I'm like, oh, okay. So you're just thinking that little Black girls are just throwing themselves at somebody so they can get an extra bowl to calico and some biscuits or whatever. And that's when I began to understand that this is racist, and it's intersectional oppression, that there is a way that Black women are framed. There is a way that little Black kids of all genders are adultified, so that if you do something against them, they deserved it or they wanted it or their bodies were big. And so you thought they were older and blah, 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 blah. And that's when I started saying, if I am going to morally indict this name, and that was my intention. Go ahead.
I want to read exactly what you write in this book, because you talk about what happened with Thomas Jefferson in a kind of scholarly language, and then you shift. You write in that chapter that it's Black history as a trigger warning.
History is a trigger warning, yes. And one of the reasons I do that is, you know, I understand some people get triggered by particular things, but if all we're going to do is avoid or ignore the things that we find distasteful or that upset us, then we're not going to know anything about this country, because this country was founded upon genocide, upon murder, upon intimate assault. This country had a brutal founding. And this is one of the reasons that you have people right now in the government who are trying to erase things you know, a la 1984, because, you know, if you call these men, these white men, your ancestors, then what does that mean as we come forward? Here's the thing nobody's thinking about. I'm descended from white men too. This is in my bloodline. And I have to deal with that. But I also have people who were abusive in my African bloodline. And so we just got to deal with it. It doesn't mean that that's you. It just means you can get past it. But you have to grapple with it before you begin to say, I don't want to be that person. Okay? That was in my bloodline, or that was in this country's founding. But we want to become a more perfect union. And becoming a perfect union does not mean that you erase what happens. It means that you reckon with it.
I think what you just said is so important, and it's something that you've referenced before, that you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, you talk in the book that, you know, you're grateful to the first wave feminists of the 19th century, even though they were incredibly racist.
Okay. And when we say first wave, I would like to say first wave white feminists, because Black women were advocating for women's rights as well. But yes, my thing is, am I going to give away the rights that mainstream, i.e. white feminism, gave me simply because I'm mad? You know, I can own my own home in my own name. I have my own checking account in my own name. I have my own credit card in my own name. All of these things were a result of mainstream white feminists, okay? So absolutely not. And then you have someone like a Gloria Steinem who, again, good white folks, right? Connecting with Black and brown feminists. In the same way that the civil rights movement finally gave Black women the right to vote, okay? Black people, the right to vote. Am I going to throw Martin Luther King out because he was homophobic and use Bayard Rustin to be the architect of the nonviolent social change movement, and then all of a sudden they just got rid of this meme? Am I going to throw out Malcolm X, who was virulently sexist, while at the same time we now know was probably bisexual? Yeah. I mean, not probably. Let's say maybe he didn't identify as bisexual, but he certainly was sleeping with a man at one point in his life. Manning Marble's book, I believe it's Manning Marble's biography of Malcolm X. Am I going to just be like, I mean, if you wait until everything is perfect, you're not going to have anything.
And this works so much against what I think the trend toward purity signaling.
Council culture. Yeah, all of that. Yeah.
I mean, we are complex people. But how have you negotiated that? In other words, what are the criteria that you hold for bringing us together in our sometimes clashing diversity in this country in such a way that builds solidarity without compromising ourselves?
Ooh, that's a question. And I'm not really sure I know the answer to that. What I know is this, and I think that you have really put your finger on what I'm trying to do on a macro level with this book, talking about American history as it connects to Black women, the way that Black women have been framed as abominations in this country, and on a micro level, as a Black woman in my community and in my family, this is why I love to talk to you, and in my family, how we negotiate this. I think that when someone is dead, there's only so much you can do, right? And you can talk honestly about the person. But I don't think that, you know, I run into my father's former students frequently. I just ran into one last week. And he said, I have a letter of recommendation that your father wrote me. And I said, you know, I would love to have a copy of that. And he said, really? I said, of course. And then I said to him, you know, I loved my daddy, even though he was not a good person. But if good works get you into heaven, then surely he is there now. And so I think that on a personal level, when I began to look at these things, I think that when someone's dead, you know, particularly in my community and in the Africana, which is, you know, African and African American. Africana is the diaspora, right? In certain cultures that are within the Africana global population, people believe that ancestors continue to grow as people on the next plane. I, of course, don't know if that's true, but I believe that and I hope that. When someone is living, that's different. Amends must be made. You know, as for my mother, well, she had early dementia. And so I let go of that because I felt like the person that I had clashed with was gone. And the only person that was left was this beautiful, sweet lady who had been my best friend when I was a child. So I let go of that. How? I have no idea. I wished I could tell you. You know, this is not a how-to book. This is only a public and a personal memoir. But I do think that one of the things that has happened, let me just deal with my community, with Black folks. And people are always talking about how angry Black people are. Well, you know, you too would be angry if somebody was constantly gaslighting you, telling you slavery is in the past, but then you want to talk about George Washington, who owned slaves, Thomas Jefferson, who owned slaves, half of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, they owned slaves, right? All of these people. And so you're looking at them, the first and the second Continental Congress, half of them, they owned slaves. So you're looking like, okay, well, so you're saying only half of the history. Then we're looking at what's going on right now in Israel, that you have people who, because of their religion, can claim that they have a right to live someplace, even if their ancestors were gone thousands of years ago. And then, but Palestinians are supposed to forget something that only happened 75 years ago. That is a contradiction. The fact that we have given Israel, how many billions of dollars do we give them every single year, ignoring all of the ugliness that they do to the Palestinians? Then when the Palestinians get ready to fight back, we decide that's not the proper way to fight back. But then when we can get ready to bomb somebody, that's okay. And meanwhile, Black folks have been asking for their 40 acres and a mule, perhaps upgraded to a top of the line, you know, tractor. We still have not received any of that. This is why Black people are so angry. And not only that, I will say this. I would say that so much of our anger is really just grief, because you want our blues, but you don't want us. You want our music. You want our style. You want our love. We've been trying to talk to you for many centuries now, ever since those Black men sent those petitions to the Massachusetts General Court in the 18th century. We have been trying to tell you all, if you don't stop with this, we are headed to destruction. Now is time for you to learn. Within another 2 to 3 months, people who voted for this are going to start getting cut off, Medicaid, Social Security. And it's horrible. For me, you know, I was never on the street. I have social anxiety. I, you know, have been assaulted many times going back to when I was a child. So I'm afraid of doing that again. So what I do is I raise my voice. There was a moment where I was like, I'm just going to hide out in my house. And then something came to me. I don't know if it was my conscience, if it was the Lord that said, Honoree, you're an elder now. You cannot remain silent. Your elders raised their voice. If they weren't out in the street, they wrote about it. You know, I was terrified for this book to come out because when I wrote it, Francesca, I just thought it was about the past. You know, I'm going to begin with something about January the 6th. I thought, well, you know, that's the past. Because I was like, well, I knew Kamala Harris wasn't going to win. But as I've said, I prayed for, and I sure enough was at that poll bright and early voting for her. All my friends, except for one, voted for her, right? But then when she lost, then I realized, uh-oh. This is a whole different book because this book is very scorching. And, you know, I thought, you know, my work has been scorching ever since I was a very young woman. And I've spoken to people that said, wow, this book is very prescient. And I said, yes. And that is very weird because I didn't think it was going to be prescient. I thought it was going to be about the past. And then my editor insisted that I write a piece on Kamala Harris, which I did not want to do. Because my book is about an African-American African, Matrilon. And while there is no doubt that Kamala Harris is a Black woman, you cannot get much more Black than someone who pledged Alpha Kappa Alpha at Howard University. But my work is usually about Black women who come from Black women and so on and so forth. But my editor insisted and I was really cranky about it. And then now I realize that was for the best because it makes the book timely. And we don't know what's going to happen. I mean, things are rapidly happening. Birthright citizenship. And if Black people do not think that they can take birthright citizenship away from us, I mean, that's why birthright citizenship was given, was because of us. But I know one thing, they not taking me alive. And as my grandma said, I mean that thing. I will fight. I don't want to, but I feel like, and I know that this country is going into armed conflict. You know, as I've told people, we are right at taxation without representation. We are right at British soldiers occupying the street. And so I'm scared, but I know that the only way forward is through. So I know that's probably not what you wanted to hear about diverse connection, but it's going to come a time where people are going to have to let all of that foolishness of white supremacy, racism, go. So sooner or later, all of that classism, the racism, in order for us to survive, that, as I call it, you know, the rat wanna be better than the roach. All of that's gonna have to fall away. Or white people. Now, that's going to be the hard one, but in order for us to survive.
Yeah, I have often felt that where we are now is a direct consequence of slavery. I mean, not only that the white supremacists have taken over our government, But, you know, we've never dealt with slavery, and this is what happens. But I also feel that many younger people and old folks as well, there's a growing sense of the need of solidarity. It's like what you talk about, Honoré Fanon Jeffers, in Misbehaving at the Crossroads, rememory. Let's rememory the solidarity that has always been there between people, that's been hidden by those who rule.
Well, and I think, you know, as I talk earlier in the book, in that chapter, Our Fathers Who Rewrote Our Mothers, where I talk about how the legislation was weaponized against Black women. But there's a tiny little portion where I talk about Bacon's Rebellion. Every time in this country, you have working class white people joining with Black people, the oligarchs find some way to throw a monkey wrench in there. Every single time. Bacon's Rebellion, even the American Revolution. How many people know that the first person that fell in the Boston Massacre, you do, was an Afro-Indigenous man, Crispus Attucks, in 1770? Very few people. Very few people know that at least 5,000 Black men fought the revolutionary side of the American Revolution. Very few people know that. Very few people know that Black men have fought in every single armed conflict going back even before the American Revolution and what they call the French Indian Wars. So there's all of this happening. And every time working class white folks start joining, there's that sharecropper and farmer movement, right? Mm-hmm. The labor movement that Robin D.G. Kelly talks about, and the way that working class, you know, white farmers and Black farmers were joining together, and they found some way to get up in the middle of that all along the way. And the latest was Obama.
The Farmer Labor Party, yes. And George Floyd. Look what happened.
Yeah. Look what happened with the Black Lives Matter, where we had all of this multiracial coalition fighting against police brutality. And then we got in there and, you know, somebody started throwing red meat. And, you know, do you really want to be on the same level with these people? Next thing you know, January the 6th led us right here. But I'm going to tell you something right now. To paraphrase the great Zora Neale Hurston, when that big gut leaned over and grabbed that little gut, which means hunger, when that hunger keeps going, and people think, oh, well, we're going to get these concentration camps going on, and we're going to put these quote unquote illegal Americans, no one's illegal on stolen land. Okay. Well, we're going to do all of that, and then we're going to figure it out. But the thing is, they haven't figured out what are they going to do when people start fighting back? Because some people do not want their names connected with this. Some people are like ashamed. There's a lot of shame over that. And I've felt really good to see people, like older white people, out there on the streets in places like Idaho. I have been shocked. Not just, wow, that's great, but shocked. People don't want this because, you know, it's cruel.
Well, it's been great to talk with you again, Honoré Fanon Jeffers. And I love this book, Misbehaving at the Crossroads. It's just a terrific read. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
And go to writersvoice.net to hear our 2021 conversation with Jeffers about her novel, The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. Climate Week will be coming up in September, so we'll be featuring several conversations with activists, including Bill McKibben and the world-renowned climate scientist Michael Mann, and also one of the great leaders of the environmental justice movement, Catherine Coleman Flowers. Here's a sneak preview to our conversation with her about her new book, Holy Ground. I have been eager to talk with you for a long time, so when I heard about your new book, I jumped on it. I'm a big fan of yours. And this book of essays, although I actually would call them stories because they are so compelling and so beautifully written. You begin the book, Holy Ground, by talking about how Jesus Christ was betrayed by 30 pieces of silver. You draw a parallel to how the powerful, not only in this country, but in the world, are selling out humanity for money. And you say we need to transform values. Say more about that. What are the values that we need to transform to?
Well, I think it's very important for us to, first of all, have a deep respect for Mother Earth. You know, I grew up understanding that Mother Nature was powerful, but she also provides for us, and we have to make sure that what she provides for us will last for generations to come, that we're not greedy. At my home recently, I put up a bird feeder, and in this bird feeder, I can see the different types of birds come in my backyard to eat the seeds. And when they eat the seeds, they drop the seeds on the ground. When they drop the seeds on the ground, then I see the squirrels would go and eat the seeds that are on the ground. It only becomes a problem when someone becomes greedy. So a raccoon came into my yard, and the raccoon tore down the bird feeder. Nobody else was able to eat. So the parallels are that even in nature, I've just saw examples of that where everybody was living peacefully because there was like an interdependence where when the birds got the bird seeds and it fell on the ground, then the squirrels were able to eat. But when the raccoon got greedy, nobody was able to eat. Likewise with Mother Earth and our respect for the environment, we have to make sure that it'll be here for the generations to come. And I feel that, you know, a lot of people for money will change their values. And when they get the money, they don't think about what is happening with people from around the world and how it could create the kind of imbalance where the future generations may not be able to survive. And I think if we have this respect for these values, and I always, when I think about how politicians make deals to sell out their community, that's where 30 pieces of silver comes in. Because for me, I was inspired by the story of Judas, and I'm a Christian. So in the story of Judas, Judas was a disciple of Christ, but Judas at the time was more influenced by the money. And I think about that as it relates to today's politics, where people are voting against their interests or voting against the interests of the communities that they have pledged to represent, and it hasn't gone well. And consequently, I think that in order for us to see this, I was trying to show parallels between what happened with Judas and Christ and what is happening with us now.
You are motivated very much by your faith, and you talk in the book at your dismay that so many in the evangelical community are doing exactly what you are doing. Talk about your faith and how it animates your work.
Well, my faith is one of the things that has kept me grounded through everything that I've been through, you know, all my 60 plus years on earth and all the things that I've dealt with living through the civil rights movement and hearing the stories of lynchings and, you know, families being displaced. I'm big into genealogy. But I also feel that we have to be forgiving. And it's because of my faith that I've been able to do the things that I've been able to do. And I can also step out there and do things just knowing that God is there for me, as long as I'm doing it in the spirit of service. So, you know, as I look at my history, my family's history, it's only faith that got me to where I am today. And the fact that when I look at my genealogy and I can see that my makeup as a person, I have DNA from different parts of the world and at different intersections in history. You know, when I look and I see that I have Portuguese ancestry, I think about the slave trade. And then I look at my Dutch ancestry, same thing. It's just all of these things that intersect with my African ancestry. And then I look at my Indian, my Native American ancestry. And one of the stories I talk about the Battle of Holy Ground and how potentially I know that I had people that were on both sides of that battle, fighting with Native Americans and fighting against Native Americans. But to not be dismayed, my faith has allowed me to see it for what it is and to take the good and use that to try to serve humanity.
Yeah, your book is called Holy Ground. Say a little bit more about Holy Ground, the battle, but also the deep personal meaning that that place has for you.
Wow, so Holy Ground is this beautiful place along the Alabama River. And it was holy to the indigenous people at that time. And the battle occurred because settlers were moving into their territory, and there were several different attacks as a result. And they sent in Andrew Jackson. This was before he was elected president. And he ended up coming down with a group of people to put down, quote, and I'm saying this in quotes, put down this rebellion, if you will. And it happened along the Alabama River in Lowndes County, Alabama, which is where I'm from. And there were people that were at the Battle of Holy Ground that were indigenous, but I found out that there were also African Americans that were there. And when I found this out, this was after I had actually been at a ceremony at Holy Ground with Corinna Gore and the Climate Reality Project. We did a climate training in Lowndes County, Alabama. And for some reason, I just felt the need that we should start it off with an earth-honoring ceremony at the site of the Battle of Holy Ground. And when we went to Holy Ground for this, we didn't think that a lot of people would show up, but there were more people than we anticipated that would be there that early in the morning that had come from all over the state. And this particular ceremony was led by people who were indigenous. And we stood in a circle. And before standing in that circle, we were told to pick up soil from the earth. And we had it in our hands. We dug the soil with our hands and we held it. But we had our eyes closed. And during the ceremony, I could feel the soil moving in my hand. Mm-hmm. I thought I had picked up a word. But in addition to that, you could literally hear the fish jumping out of the Alabama River. And then a flock of birds flew over us and started singing. It was the most amazing thing that I had ever seen. And after the ceremony was over, they said, now you can speak and tell us who among us are indigenous. And almost everybody in the circle had indigenous ancestry. And they took the dirt and put it in a container and gave it to me as a gift. And I still have that dirt today. And I feel that my connection to Holy Ground, I didn't know at that time until I started doing the genealogical studies that I actually had ancestors that were there as well. So it was very powerful to me. And still, whenever I wanted to calm my anxiety, I would go to Holy Ground because it's very, very peaceful now. And I felt that maybe my ancestors were speaking to me.
That was a preview of our upcoming episode of Writer's Voice with Catherine Coleman Flowers, talking with her about her new book, Holy Ground, on activism, environmental justice, and finding hope. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, check out our archives, and find out more about this week's guests. You can find our social media links there, too. And don't forget to subscribe, like, and link to our podcast. It really helps to spread the word about the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.